He sank back onto one knee.
Your Grace, I have the honour to be Quentin Martell, a Prince of Dawn, and your most leal subject.
Danny laughed. The Dornish prince flushed red, whilst her own court and councillors gave her puzzled looks.
Radiance, said Scarhaus Shavepate, in the Gascari tongue. Why'd you laugh?
They call him Frog, she said, and we've just learned why. In the Seven Kingdoms, there are children's tales of frogs who turn into enchanted princes when kissed by their true love.
Smiling at the Dornish knights, she switched back to the common tongue.
Tell me, Prince Quentin, are you enchanted?
No, Your Grace.
I feared as much. Neither enchanted nor enchanting, alas. A pity he's the prince, and not the one with the wide shoulders and the sandy hair. You have come for a kiss, however. You mean to marry me. It's not the way of it. The gift you bring me is your own sweet self. Instead of Viserys and your sister, you and I must seal this pact, if I want Dawn.
My father hoped that you might find me acceptable. Dario Naharis gave a scornful laugh.
I say you are a pup. The queen needs a man beside her, not a mewling boy. You are no fit husband for a woman such as her. When you lick your lips, do you still taste your mother's milk?
Sir Gareth Drinkwater darkened at his words. Mind your tongue, sellsword. You're speaking to a prince of Dawn.
And to his wet nurse, I am thinking.
Dario brushed his thumbs across his sword hilts and smiled dangerously. Scarhaus scowled, as only he could scowl.
This boy might serve for Dawn, but Meereen needs a king of Gascari blood.
I know of this Dawn, said Resnick Mo Resnick.
Dawn is sand and scorpions, and bleak red mountains baking in the sun.
Prince Quentin answered him.
Dawn is 50,000 spears and swords, pledged to our queen's service.
50,000, mocked Daria. I count three.
Enough, Daenerys said. Prince Quentin has crossed half the world to offer me his gift. I will not have him treated with discourtesy.
She turned to the Dornishman.
Would that you had come a year ago. I am pledged to wed the noble Histar Zolorek.
Sir Gareth said, It is not too late.
I will be the judge of that, Daenerys said. Resnick, see that the prince and his companions are given quarters suitable to their high birth, and that their wants are attended to.
As you wish, your radiance.
The queen rose.
Then we are done for now.
Dario and Sir Barristan followed her up the steps to her apartments. This changes everything, the old knight said.
This changes nothing, Danny said, as he removed her crown. What good are three men?
Three knights, said Selmy.
Three liars, Dario said darkly. They deceive me.
And bought you too, I do not doubt.
He did not trouble to deny it. Danny unrolled the parchment and examined it again.
Bravas. This was done in Bravas, while we were living in the house with the red door.
Why did that make her feel so strange? She found herself remembering her nightmare.
Sometimes there is truth in dreams.
Could Histar Zolorek be working for the warlocks? Was that what the dream had meant? Could the dream have been ascending? Were the gods telling her to put Histar aside and wed this Dornish prince instead? Something tickled at her memory.
Sir Barristan, what are the arms of House Martell?
A sun in splendour, transfixed by a spear.
The sun's sun. A shiver went through her. Shadows and whispers. What else? Had Quaise said. The pale mare and the sun's sun. There was a line in it, too, and and a dragon. Or am I the dragon? Beware the perfume seneschal.
That she remembered.
Dreams and prophecies. Why must they always be in riddles? I hate this. Oh, leave me, sir. Tomorrow is my wedding day.
That night Dario had her every way a man can have a woman, and she gave herself to him willingly. The last time, as the sun was coming up, she used her mouth to make him hard again, as Dario had taught her long ago, then rode him so wildly that his wound began to bleed again, and for one sweet heartbeat she could not tell whether he was inside her or she inside him. But when the sun rose upon her wedding day, so did Dario Naharis, donning his clothes and buckling on his sword belt with its gleaming golden wantons.
"Where are you going?"
Danny asked him.
"I forbid you to make a sortie today."
"My queen is cruel," her captain said. "If I cannot slay your foes, how shall I amuse myself whilst you are being wed?"
"By nightfall, I shall have no foes."
"It is only dawn, sweet queen. The day is long. Time enough for one last sortie. I will bring you back the head of Brown Ben Plum for a wedding gift."
"No heads," Danny insisted. "Once you brought me flowers."
"Let Histar bring you flowers. He's not one to stoop and pluck a dandelion, true, but he has servants who will be pleased to do it for him. Do I have your leave to go?"
"No."
She wanted him to stay and hold her.
"One day he will go and not return," she thought. "One day some archer will put an arrow through his chest, or 10 men will fall on him with spears and swords and axes. 10 would-be heroes.
5 of them would die, but that would not make her grief easier to bear.
One day I will lose him, as I lost my sun and stars. But please, gods, not today. Come back to bed and kiss me."
No one had ever kissed her like Dario Naharis.
"I am your queen, and I command you to fuck me."
She had meant it playfully, but Dario's eyes hardened at her words. "Fucking queens is king's work. Your noble Histar can attend to that once you're wed. And if he proves to be too highborn for such sweaty work, he has servants who will be pleased to do that for him as well. Or perhaps you can call the Dornish boy into your bed, and his pretty friend as well. Why not?" He strode from the bedchamber.
"He's going to make a sortie," Danny realized, "and if he takes Ben Plum's head, he'll walk into the wedding feast and throw it at my feet. 7 saved me. Why couldn't he be better born?"
When he was gone, Missandei brought the queen a simple meal of goat cheese and olives, with raisins for a sweet.
"Your grace needs more than wine to break her fast. You are such a tiny thing, and you will surely need your strength today."
That made Daenerys laugh, coming from a girl so small. She relied so much on the little scribe that she oft forgot that Missandei had only turned 11. They shared the food together on her terrace. As Danny nibbled on an olive, the Naarthi girl gazed at her with eyes like molten gold and said,
"It is not too late to tell them that you have decided not to wed."
"It is, though," the queen thought sadly. "Histar's blood is ancient and noble. Our joining will join my freedmen to his people.
When we become as one, so will our city. Your grace does not love the noble Histar. This one thinks you would sooner have another for your husband." "I must not think of Dario today. A queen loves where she must, not where she will."
Her appetite had left her.
"Take this food away," she told Missandei. "It's time I bathed."
Afterward, as Jiqui
was patting Daenerys dry,
Eri approached with her toka. Dany envied the Dothraki maids, their loose sand-silk trousers and painted vests. They would be much cooler than her in her toka, with its heavy fringe of baby pearls.
"Help me wind this round myself, please. I cannot manage all these pearls by myself."
She should be eager with anticipation for her wedding and the night that would follow, she knew. She remembered the night of her first wedding, when Khal Drogo had claimed her maidenhead beneath the stranger stars. She remembered how frightened she had been and how excited. Would it be the same with Isdar?
"No, I am not the girl I was, and he is not my son and stars."
Missandei re-emerged from inside the pyramid.
"Resnek and Skahaz beg the honor of escorting your grace to the Temple of the Graces. Resnek has ordered your palanquin made ready."
Myrinese seldom rode within their city walls. They preferred palanquins, litters, and sedan chairs, borne upon the shoulders of their slaves. "Horses befoul the streets," one man of Zak had told her. "Slaves do not." Dany had freed the slaves, yet palanquins, litters, and sedan chairs still choked the streets as before, and none of them floated magically through the air.
"The day is too hot to be shut up in a palanquin," said Dany. "Have my silver saddled. I would not go to my lord husband upon the backs of bearers."
"Your grace," said Missandei, "this one is so sorry, but you cannot ride in a toka." The little scribe was right, as she so often was. The toka was not a garment meant for horseback. Dany made a face.
"As you say, not the palanquin, though. I would suffocate behind those drapes. Have them ready a sedan chair."
If she must wear her floppy ears, let all the rabbits see her. When Dany made her descent, Resnek and Skahaz dropped to their knees.
"Your worship shines so brightly, you will blind every man who dares to look upon you," said Resnek.
The seneschal wore a toka of maroon samite with golden fringes.
"Hisdar Zolaric is most fortunate in you, and you and him, if I may be so bold as to say. This match will save our city. You will see."
"So we pray. I want to plant my olive trees and see them fruit. Does it matter that Hisdar's kisses do not please me? Peace will please me. Am I a queen or just a woman?"
"The crowds will be thick as flies today."
The shavepate was clad in a pleated black skirt and a muscled breastplate, with a brazen helm shaped like a serpent's head beneath one arm.
"Should I be afraid of flays? Your brazen beasts will keep me safe from any harm."
It was always dusk inside the base of the Great Pyramid. Walls 30 feet thick muffled the tumult of the streets and kept the heat outside, so it was cool and dim within. Her escort was forming up inside the gates. Horses, mules, and donkeys were stabled in the western walls, elephants in the eastern. Dany had acquired 3 of those huge, queer beasts with her pyramid. They reminded her of hairless grey mammoths, though their tusks had been barbed and gilded, and their eyes were sad. She found Strong Belwas eating grapes, as Barristan Selmy watched the stable boy cinch the girth on his dapple grey. The 3 Dornishmen were with him, talking, but they broke off when the queen appeared. Their prince went to one knee.
"Your grace, I must entreat you. My father's strength is failing, but his devotion to your cause is as strong as ever. If my manner or my person have displeased you, that is my sorrow, but—" "If you would please me, sir, be happy for me," Daenerys said. "This is my wedding day. They will be dancing in the Yellow City, I do not doubt. She sighed. Rise, my prince, and smile. One day I shall return to Westeros to claim my father's throne and look to Dorne for help. But on this day the Yunkai have my city ringed in steel. I may die before I see my seven kingdoms. Hisdar may die. Westeros may be swallowed by the waves. Danny kissed his cheek. Come, it's time I wed.
Sir Barristan helped her up onto her sedan chair. Quentin rejoined his fellow Dornishmen. Strong Belwas bellowed for the gates to be opened, and Daenerys Targaryen was carried forth into the sun. Selmy fell in beside her on his dapple grey.
Tell me, Danny said,
as the procession turned toward the Temple of the Graces.
If my father and my mother had been free to follow their own hearts, whom would they have wed?
It was long ago. Your Grace would not know them.
You know, though. Tell me.
The old knight inclined his head. The Queen, your mother, was always mindful of her duty. He was handsome in his gold and silver armor, his white cloak streaming from his shoulders, but he sounded like a man in pain, as if every word were a stone he had to pass. As a girl, though, she was once smitten with a young knight from the Stormlands who wore her favor at a tourney and named her Queen of Love and Beauty. A brief thing.
What happened to this knight?
He put away his lance the day your lady mother wed your father. Afterward, he became most pious, and was heard to say that only the maiden could replace Queen Rhaella in his heart. His passion was impossible, of course. A landed knight is no fit consort for a princess of royal blood.
And Dario Naharis is only a sellsword, not fit to buckle on the golden spurs of even a landed knight. And my father, was there some woman that he loved better than his queen?
Sir Barristan shifted in the saddle. Not loved.
Mayhaps wanted is a better word, but it was only kitchen gossip, the whispers of washerwomen and stable boys. I want to know. I never knew my father. I want to know everything about him, the good and the rest. As you command.
The White Knight chose his words with care.
Prince Aerys, as a youth, he was taken with a certain lady of Castle Rock, a cousin of Tywin Lannister. When she and Tywin wed, your father drank too much wine at the wedding feast, and was heard to say that it was a great pity that the Lord's right to the first knight had been abolished. A drunken jape, no more. But Tywin Lannister was not a man to forget such words, or the liberties your father took during the bedding.
His face reddened.
I have said too much, Your Grace. Gracious Queen, well met.
Another procession had come up beside her own, and Hisdar Zolorek was smiling at her from his own sedan chair.
My king.
Danny wondered where Dario Naharis was, what he was doing.
If this was a story, he would gallop up just as we reached the temple to challenge Hisdar for my hand.
Side by side, the queen's procession and Hisdar Zolorek's made their slow way across Meereen, until finally the Temple of the Graces loomed up before them, its golden domes flashing in the sun.
How beautiful,
the queen tried to tell herself. But inside her was some foolish little girl who could not help but look about for Dario.
If he loved you, he would come and carry you off at Swordpoint, as Rhaegar carried off his northern girl.
The girl in her insisted. but the Queen knew that was folly. Even if her captain was mad enough to attempt it, the brazen beasts would cut him down before he got within 100 yards of her. Galazi Galari awaited them outside the temple doors. Surrounded by her sisters in white and pink and red, blue and gold and purple.
There are fewer than there were.
Danny looked for Azara and did not see her.
Has the bloody flux taken even her?
Though the queen had let the Astapori starve outside her walls to keep the bloody flux from spreading, it was spreading nonetheless. Many had been stricken. Freedmen, sellswords, brazen beasts, even Dothraki, though as yet none of the unsullied had been touched. She prayed the worst was past. The Graces brought forth an ivory chair and a golden bowl. Holding her tokar daintily so as not to tread upon its fringes, Daenerys Targaryen eased herself onto the chair's plush velvet seat, and Hisdar Zolorek went to his knees, unlaced her sandals, and washed her feet, whilst 50 eunuchs sang, and 10,000 eyes looked on.
"He has gentle hands," she mused, as warm, fragrant oils ran between her toes. "If he has a gentle heart as well, I may grow fond of him, in time."
When her feet were clean, Hisdar dried them with a soft towel, laced her sandals on again, and helped her stand. Hand in hand, they followed the Green Grace inside the temple, where the air was thick with incense and the guards of Gis stood cloaked in shadows in their alcoves. 4 hours later, they emerged again as man and wife, bound together wrist and ankle with chains of yellow gold.
Eddard. Through the high, narrow windows of the Red Keep's cavernous throne room, the light of sunset spilled across the floor, laying dark red stripes upon the walls where the heads of dragons had once hung. Now the stone was covered with hunting tapestries, vivid with greens and browns and blues, and yet it still seemed to Ned Stark that the only colour in the hall was the red of blood. He sat high upon the immensely ancient seat of Aegon the Conqueror, an ironwork monstrosity of spikes and jagged edges and grotesquely twisted metal. It was, as Robert had warned him, a hellishly uncomfortable chair, and never more so than now, with his shattered leg throbbing more sharply every minute. The metal beneath him had grown harder by the hour, and the fang steel behind made it impossible to lean back. A king should never sit easy, Aegon the Conqueror had said, when he commanded his armourers to forge a great seat from swords laid down by his enemies. Damn Aegon for his arrogance, Ned thought sullenly, and damn Robert and his hunting as well.
You are quite certain these are more than brigands, Varys asked softly from the council table beneath the throne.
Grand Maester Pycelle stirred uneasily beside him, while Littlefinger toyed with a pen. They were the only councillors in attendance. A white hart had been sighted in the Kingswood, and Lord Renly and Sir Barristan had joined the king to hunt it, along with Prince Joffrey, Sandor Clegane, Balin Swan, and half the court. So Ned must needs sit the Iron Throne in his absence. At least, he could sit. Save the council, the rest must stand respectfully or kneel. The petitioners clustered near the tall doors, the knights and high lords and ladies beneath the tapestries, the small folk in the gallery, the male guards in their cloaks, gold or grey, all stood. The villagers were kneeling, men, women and children, alike, tattered and bloody, their faces drawn by fear. The three knights who had brought them here to bear witness stood behind them. "Brigands, Lord Varys." Sir Raymond Darry's voice dripped scorn.
Oh, they were brigands beyond a doubt. Lannister brigands. Ned could feel the unease in the hall, as high lords and servants alike strained to listen. He could not pretend to surprise. The West had been a tinderbox since Catelyn had seized Tyrion Lannister. Both Riverrun and Castle Rock had called their banners, and armies were massing in the pass below the Golden Tooth. It had only been a matter of time until the blood began to flow. The sole question that remained was how best to staunch the wound. Sad-eyed, Sir Carol Vance, who would have been handsome but for the wine-stained birthmark that discoloured his face, gestured at the kneeling villagers. "This is all that remains of the holdfast of Shearer, Lord Eddard. The rest are dead, along with the people of Wendish Town and the Mummer's Ford." "Rise," Ned commanded the villagers. He never trusted what a man told him from his knees. "All of you, up!" In ones and twos, the holdfast of Shearer struggled to its feet. One ancient needed to be helped, and a young girl in a bloody dress stayed on her knees, staring blankly at Sir Aerys Oakheart, who stood by the foot of the throne in the white armour of the King's Guard, ready to protect and defend the king. Or Ned supposed the king's hand. "Joss," Sir Raymond Darry said to a plump, balding man in a brewer's apron, "tell the hand what happened at Shearer." Joss nodded.
"If it please his grace."
"His grace is hunting across the Blackwater," Ned said, wondering how a man could live his whole life a few days' ride from the Red Keep and still have no notion what his king looked like. Ned was clad in a white linen doublet with a direwolf of Stark on the breast. His black wool cloak was fastened at the collar by the silver hand of office. Black and white and grey, all the shades of truth. "I am Lord Eddard Stark, the king's hand. Tell me who you are and what you know of these raiders."
I capped an alehouse, my lord, in Shearer, by the Stone Bridge. The finest ale south of the Neck. Everyone said so, begging your pardons, my lord. It's gone now, like all the rest, my lord. They come and drank their fill and spilled the rest before they fired my roof. And they would have spilled my blood, too, if they caught me, my lord.
They burnt us out, a farmer beside him said. Come riding in the dark, up from the south, and fired the fields and the houses alike. Killing them is trying to stop them. There weren't no raiders, though, my lord. They had no mind to steal our stock, not these. They butchered my milk cow where she stood, and left her for the flies and the crows.
They rode down my prentice boy, said a squat man, with a smith's muscles and a bandage around his head.
He had put on his finest clothes to come to court, but his breeches were patched, his cloak travel-stained and dusty.
Chased him back and forth across the fields on their horses, poking at him with their lances like it was a game, them laughing and the boys tumbling and screaming till the big one pierced him clean through.
The girl on her knees craned her head up at Ned, high above her on the throne.
They killed my mother too, your grace, and they...
Her voice trailed off, as if she had forgotten what she was about to say. She began to sob. Sir Raymond Darry took up the tale.
At Wendish Town, the people sought shelter in their holdfast, but the walls were timbered. The raiders piled straw against the wood and burnt them all alive. When the Wendish folk opened their gates to flee the fire, they shot them down with arrows as they came running out, even women with suckling babes.
"Oh, dreadful," murmured Varys. "How cruel can men be?"
"They would have done the same for us, but the Shearer hold fast made of stone," Joss said. "Some wanted to smoke us out, but the big one said there was riper fruit upriver, and they made for the Mummer's Ford."
Ned could feel cold steel against his fingers as he leaned forward. Between each finger was a blade, the points of twisted swords, fanning out like talons from the arms of the throne. Even after 3 centuries, some were still sharp enough to cut.
The Iron Throne was full of traps for the unwary. The song said it had taken 1,000 blades to make it, heated white-hot, in the furnace breath of Balerion the Black Dread. The hammering had taken 59 days. The end of it was this hunchback beast, made of razor edges and barbs and ribbons of sharp metal. A chair that could kill a man, and had, if the stories could be believed. What Eddard Stark was doing sitting there, he would never comprehend. Yet there he sat. And these people looked to him for justice. "What proof do you have that these were Lannisters?" he asked, trying to keep his fury under control. "Did they wear crimson cloaks or fly a lion banner?" "Even Lannisters are not so blind stupid as that," Sir Mark Piper snapped. He was a swaggering bantam rooster of a youth, too young and too hot-blooded for Ned's taste, though a fast friend of Catelyn's brother, Edmure Tully. "Every man among them was mounted and mailed, my lord," Sir Carol answered calmly. "They were armed with steel-tipped lances and longswords, with battle-axes for the butchery." He gestured toward one of the ragged survivors. "You, yes, you, no one's going to hurt you. Tell the hand what you told me." The old man bobbed his head.
"Concerning their horses," he said, "it were war horses they rode. Many a year I walked in old Sir Willem's stables, so I knows the difference. Not a one of these ever pulled a plough. God's bear witness if I'm wrong."
"Well mounted, brigands," observed Littlefinger. "Perhaps they stole the horses from the last place they raided." "How many men were there in this raiding party?" Ned asked. 100 at the least," Joss answered, in the same instant as the bandaged smith said, 50. And the grandmother behind him,
"Onards and onards, my lord, an army there was."
"You are more right than you know, good woman," Lord Eddard told her. "You say they flew no banners. What of the armour they wore? Did any of you note ornaments or decorations, devices on shields or helm?" The brewer, Joss, shook his head.
"It grieves me, my lord, but no. The armour they showed us was plain, only the one who led them, he was armoured like the rest, but there was no mistaking him all the same. It was the size of him, my lord. Those as say the giants are all dead never saw this one, I swear. Big as an ox he was, and a voice like stone breaking."
"The mountain," Sir Mark said loudly. "Can any man doubt it? This was Gregor Clegane's work."
Ned heard muttering from beneath the windows and the far end of the hall. Even in the galley, nervous whispers were exchanged. High lords and small folk alike knew what it could mean if Sir Mark was proved right. Sir Gregor Clegane stood bannerman to Lord Tywin Lannister. He studied the frightened faces of the villagers. Small wonder they had been so fearful. They had thought they were being dragged here to name Lord Tywin a red-handed butcher before a king who was his son by marriage. He wondered if the knights had given them a choice. Grand Maester Pycelle rose ponderously from the council table, his chain of office clinking.
"Sir Mark, with respect, you cannot know that this outlaw was Sir Gregor. There are many large men in the realm."
"As large as the mountain that rides," Sir Carol said. "I've never met one."
"Nor has any man here," Sir Raymond added hotly. "Even his brother is a pup beside him. My lords, open your eyes. Do you need to see his seal on the corpses? This was Gregor."
"Why should Sir Gregor turn brigand?" Pycelle asked. "By the grace of his liege lord, he holds a stout keep and lands of his own. The man is an anointed knight."
"A false knight," Sir Mark said. "Lord Tywin's mad dog."
"My lord hand," Pycelle declared in a stiff voice, "I urge you to remind this good knight that Lord Tywin Lannister is the father of our own gracious queen." "Thank you, Grand Maester Pycelle," Ned said. "I fear we might have forgotten that if you hadn't pointed it out." From his vantage point at the top of the throne, he could see men slipping out the door at the far end of the hall. Hares going to ground, he supposed, or rats off to nibble the Queen's cheese. He caught a glimpse of Septa Mordain in the gallery, with his daughter Sansa behind her. Ned felt a flash of anger. This was no place for a girl. But the Septa could not have known that today's court would be anything but the usual tedious business of hearing petitions, settling disputes between rival holdfasts, and adjudicating the placement of boundary stones. At the council table below, Petyr Baelish lost interest in his quill and leaned forward. "Sir Mark, Sir Carl, Sir Raymond, perhaps I might ask you a question. These holdfasts were under your protection. Where were you when all this slaughtering and burning was going on?" Sir Carl Vance answered, "I was attending my lord father in the pass below the Golden Tooth, as was Sir Mark. When the word of these outrages reached Sir Edmure Tully, he sent word that we should take a small force of men to find what survivors we could and bring them to the king." Sir Raymond Darry spoke up.
"Sir Edmure had summoned me to River Run with all my strength. I was camped across the river from his walls, awaiting his commands, when the word reached me. By the time I could return to my own lands, Clegane and his vermin were back across the Red Fork, riding for Lannister's hills."
Littlefinger stroked the point of his beard thoughtfully. "And if they come again, sir?"
"If they come again, we'll use their blood to water the fields they burnt," Sir Mark Piper declared hotly. "Sir Edmure has sent men to every village and holdfast within a day's ride of the border," Sir Carol explained. "The next raider will not have such an easy time of it."
"And that may be precisely what Lord Tywin wants," Ned thought to himself, "to bleed off strength from River Run, goad the boy into scattering his swords." His wife's brother was young, and more gallant than wise. He would try to hold every inch of his soil to defend every man, woman, and child who named him lord. And Tywin Lannister was shrewd enough to know that.
"If your fields and holdfasts are safe from harm," Lord Petyr was saying, "what then do you ask of the throne?"
"The lords of the tyrant keep the king's peace," Sir Raymond Darry said. "The Lannisters have broken it. We ask leave to answer them steel for steel. We ask justice for the small folk of Shearer and Windishtown and the Mummer's Ford."
"Edmure agrees we must pay Gregor Clegane back his bloody coin," Sir Mark declared. "But old Lord Hoster command us to come here and beg the king's leave before we strike."
"Thank the gods for old Lord Hoster, then." Tywin Lannister was as much fox as lion. If indeed he'd sent Sir Gregor to burn and pillage, and Ned did not doubt that he had, he'd taken care to see that he rode under cover of night, without banners, in the guise of a common brigand. Should River Run strike back, Cersei and her father would insist that it had been the Tullys who broke the king's peace, not the Lannisters. The guards only knew what Robert would believe. Grand Maester Pycelle was on his feet again.
"My Lord Hand, if these good folk believe that Sir Gregor has forsaken his holy vows for plunder and rape, let them go to his liege lord and make their complaint. These crimes are no concern of the throne. Let them seek Lord Tywin's justice."
"It is all the king's justice," Ned told him. "North, south, east, or west. All we do in Robert's name."
"The king's justice," Grand Maester Pycelle said. "So it is, and we should defer this matter until the king..."
"The king is hunting across the river and may not return for days," Lord Eddard said. "Robert bid me to sit here in his place, to listen with his ears and to speak with his voice. I mean to do just that. though I agree he must be told. He saw a familiar face beneath the tapestry. Sir Robert Royce stepped forward and bowed. My lord? Your father is hunting with the king, Ned said. Will you bring them word of what was said and done here today?
At once, my lord. Do we have your leave to take our vengeance against Sir Gregor, then?
Mark Piper asked the throne. Vengeance, Ned said. I thought we were speaking of justice. Burning Clegane's fields and slaughtering his people will not restore the king's peace, only your injured pride. He glanced away before the young knight could voice his outraged protest and address the villagers. People of Shara, I cannot give you back your homes or your crops, nor can I restore your dead to life. But perhaps I can give you some small measure of justice in the name of our king, Robert. Every eye in the hall was fixed on him, waiting. Slowly, Ned struggled to his feet, pushing himself up from the throne with the strength of his arms, his shattered leg screaming inside its cast. He did his best to ignore the pain. It was no moment to let them see his weakness. The first men believed that the judge who called for death should wield the sword, and in the north, we hold to that still. I mislike sending another to do my killing. Yet it seems I have no choice. He gestured at his broken leg. Lord Eddard, a shot came from the west side of the hall, as a handsome stripling of a boy strode forth boldly. Out of his armor, Solaris Tyrell looked even younger than his 16 years. He wore pale blue silk, his belt a linked chain of golden roses, the sigil of his house. I beg you the honour of acting in your place. Give this task to me, my lord, and I swear I shall not fail you. Littlefinger chuckled. Solaris, if we send you off alone, Sir Gregor will send us back your head with a plum stuffed in that pretty mouth of yours. The mountain is not the sort to bend his neck to any man's justice. I do not fear Gregor Clegane, Sir Loras said haughtily. Ned eased himself slowly back onto the hard iron seat of Aegon's misshapen throne. His eyes searched the faces along the wall. Lord Beric, he called out, Thoris of Myr, Sir Gladden, Lord Lothar. The men named stepped forward one by one. Each of you is to assemble 20 men, to bring my word to Gregor's keep. 20 of my own guard shall go with you. Lord Beric Dondarrion, you shall have the command, as befits your rank. The young lord with the red-gold hair bowed. As you command, Lord Eddard. Ned raised his voice, so it carried to the far end of the throne room. In the name of Robert, of the House Baratheon, the first of his name, King of the Andals, of the Ronar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm, by the word of Eddard of the House Stark, his hand, I charge you to ride to the Westlands with all haste, to cross the Red Fork of the Trident under the King's flag, and there bring the King's justice to the false knight Gregor Clegane. And to all those who share in his crimes, I denounce him and attaint him, and strip him of all rank and titles, of all lands and incomes and holdings, and do sentence him to death. May the gods take pity on his soul. When the echo of his words had died away, the Knight of Flowers seemed perplexed.
Lord Eddard, what of me?
Ned looked down on him. From on high, Loras Tyrell seemed almost as young as Rob. No one doubts your valour, Sir Loras, but we are about justice here, and what you seek is vengeance. He looked back to Lord Beric. Ride at first light. These things are best done quickly. He held up a hand. The throne will hear no more petitions today. Alan and Porther
climbed the steep iron steps to help him back down. As they made their descent, he could feel Loras Tyrell's sullen stare, but the boy had stalked away before Ned reached the floor of the throne room. At the base of the Iron Throne, Varys was gathering papers from the council table. Littlefinger and Grand Maester Pycelle had already taken their leave.
"You are a bolder man than I, my lord," the eunuch said softly.
"How so, Lord Varys?" Ned asked brusquely. His leg was throbbing and he was in no mood for word games.
"Had it been me up there, I should have sent Sir Loras. He so wanted to go. And a man who has the Lannisters for enemies would do well to make the Tyrells his friends."
"Sir Loras is young," said Ned. "I dare say he will outgrow the disappointment."
"And Sir Ilion?"
The eunuch stroked a plump, powdered cheek.
"He is the king's justice, after all. Sending other men to do his office, some might construe that as a grave insult."
No slight was intended. In truth, Ned did not trust the mute knight, though perhaps that was only because he misliked executioners. "I remind you, the Paynes are bannermen to House Lannister. I thought it best to choose men who owed Lord Tywin no fealty."
"Very prudent, no doubt," Varys said. "Still, I chanced to see Sir Ilion in the back of the hall, staring at us with those pale eyes of his, and I must say, he did not look pleased. Though, to be sure, it's hard to tell with our silent knight. I hope he outgrows his disappointment as well. He does so love his work."
John. The call came drifting through the black of night. John pushed himself onto an elbow, his hand reaching for Longclaw by force of habit as the camp began to stir. "The horn that wakes the sleepers," he thought. The long, low note lingered at the edge of hearing. The sentries at the ring wall stood still in their footsteps, breath frosting and heads turned towards the west. As the sound of the horn faded, even the wind ceased to blow. Men rolled from their blankets and reached for spears and sword belts, moving quietly, listening. A horse whickered and was hushed. For a heartbeat it seemed as if the whole forest were holding its breath. The brothers of the Night's Watch waited for a second blast, praying they should not hear it, fearing that they would. When the silence had stretched unbearably long, and the men knew at last that the horn would not wind again, they grinned at one another sheepishly, as if to deny that they had been anxious. Jon Snow fed a few sticks to the fire, buckled on his sword belt, pulled on his boots, shook the dirt and dew from his cloak, and fastened it around his shoulders. The flames blazed up beside him, welcome heat beating against his face as he dressed. He could hear the Lord Commander moving inside the tent. After a moment, Mormont lifted the flap. "One blast?" On his shoulder, his raven sat fluffed and silent, looking miserable. "One, my lord," John agreed. "Brothers returning." Mormont moved to the fire. "The half-hand, and past time." He had grown more restive every day they waited. Much longer, and he would have been fit to whelp cubs. "See that there's hot food for the men, and fodder for the horses. I'll see Corrin at once."
"I'll bring him, my lord." The men from the Shadow Tower had been expected days ago. When they had not appeared, the brothers had begun to wonder. John had heard gloomy mutterings around the cook fire, and not just from Dolorous Ed. Sir Otten Withers was for retreating to Castle Black as soon as possible. Sir Malador Locke would strike for the Shadow Tower, hoping to pick up Corrin's trail and learn what had befallen him. And Thorin Smallwood wanted to push on into the mountains. Mance Raider knows he must battle the watch.
Thorin had declared, but he will never look for us so far north. If we ride up the Milkwater, we can take him unawares and cut his host to ribbons before he knows we are on him.
The numbers would be greatly against us, Sir Otten had objected. Craster said he was gathering a great host, many thousands. Without Corin, we are only 200.
Send 200 wolves against 10,000 sheep, sir, and see what happens, said Smallwood confidently.
There are goats among these sheep, Thorin, warned Jarman Buckwell. Aye, and maybe a few lions. Rattleshirt, Harmer, the Dog's Head, Elfin Crow Killer.
I know them as well as you do, Buckwell, Thorin Smallwood snapped back, and I mean to have their heads, every one. These are wildlings, no soldiers, a few hundred heroes, drunk most like, amidst a great horde of women, children, and thralls. We will sweep over them and send them howling back to their ovals. They had argued for many hours and reached no agreement. The old bear was too stubborn to retreat, but neither would he rush headlong up the Milkwater, seeking battle. In the end, nothing had been decided but to wait a few more days for the men from the Shadow Tower and talk again if they did not appear. And now they had, which meant that the decision could be delayed no longer. John was glad for that much at least. If they must battle Mance Rayder, let it be soon. He found Dolorous Ed at the fire complaining about how difficult it was for him to sleep when people insisted on blowing horns in the woods. John gave him something new to complain about. Together they woke Hake, who received the Lord Commander's orders with a stream of curses, but got up all the same, and soon had a dozen brothers cutting roots for a soup. Sam came puffing up as John crossed the camp. Under the black hood, his face was as pale and round as the moon.
"I heard the horn. Has your uncle come back?"
"It's only the man from the Shadow Tower." It was growing harder to cling to the hope of Benjen Stark's safe return. The cloak he had found beneath the fist could well have belonged to his uncle or one of his men. Even the old bear admitted as much, though why they would have buried it there, wrapped around a cache of dragon glass, no one could say. "Sam, I have to go." At the ring wall, he found the guards sliding spikes from the half-frozen earth to make an opening. It was not long until the first of the brothers from the Shadow Tower began wending their way up the slope. All in leather and fur they were, with here and there a bit of steel or bronze. Heavy beards covered hard, lean faces and made them look as shaggy as their garrons. John was surprised to see some of them were riding two to a horse. When he looked more closely, it was plain that many of them were wounded. There has been trouble on the way. John knew Corin Halfhand the instant he saw him, though they had never met. The big ranger was half a legend in the watch, a man of slow words and swift action, tall and straight as a spear, long-limbed and solemn. Unlike his men, he was clean-shaven. His hair fell from beneath his helm, in a heavy braid touched with hoarfrost, and the blacks he wore were so faded that they might have been greys. Only thumb and forefinger remained on the hand that held the reins. The other fingers had been sheared off catching a wildling's axe that would otherwise have split his skull. It was told that he had thrust his maimed fist into the face of the axeman so the blood spurted into his eyes and slew him while he was blind. Since that day, the wildlings beyond the wall had known no foe more implacable. John hailed him. "Lord Commander Mormont would see you at once. I'll show you to his tent." Corin swung down from his saddle. "My men are hungry, and our horses require tending. They'll all be seen to." The ranger gave his horse into the care of one of his men and followed. "You are John Snow. You have your father's look."
"Did you know him, my lord?"
"I am no lordling, only a brother of the Night's Watch. I knew Lord Eddard, yes, and his father before him." John had to hurry his steps to keep up with Corin's long strides.
Lord Rickard died before I was born. He was a friend of the Watch. Corrin glanced behind. It is said that a direwolf runs with you. Ghost should be back by dawn. He hunts at night. They found Dolores Ed frying a rasher of bacon and boiling a dozen eggs in a kettle over the old bear's cook fire. Mormont sat in his wood and leather camp chair.
I'd begun to fear for you. Did you meet with trouble?
We met with Alfrin Crowkiller. Mance had sent him to scout along the wall, and we chanced on him returning. Corrin removed his helm. Alfrin will trouble the realm no longer, but some of his company escaped us. We hunted down as many as we could, but it may be that a few will win back to the mountains. And the cost? 4 brothers dead, 12 wounded. 1/3 as many as the foe. And we took captives. 1 died quickly from his wounds, but the other lived long enough to be questioned. Best talk of this inside. John will fetch your horn of hail, or would you prefer hot spiced wine? Boil water would suffice, an egg and a bite of bacon. As you wish. Mormont lifted the flap of the tent, and Corrin Halfhand stooped and stepped through. Ed stood over the kettle, swishing the eggs about with a spoon.
Cor, I envy those eggs, he said. I could do with a bit of boiling about now, eh? If the kettle were larger, I might jump in, eh? Though I would sooner it were wine than water, eh? There are worse ways to die than warm and drunk. I knew a brother drowned himself in wine once. It was a poor vintage, though, and his corpse did not improve it, eh?
You drank the wine?
It's an awful thing to find a brother dear, eh? You'd have need of a drink as well, Lord Snow.
Ed stirred the kettle and added a pinch more nutmeg. Restless, John squatted by the fire and poked at it with a stick. He could hear the old bear's voice inside the tent, punctuated by the raven's squawks and Corrin Halfhand's quieter tones, but he could not make out the words.
Alfin Crowkiller dead? That's good.
He was one of the bloodiest of the wildling raiders, taking his name from the black brothers he'd slain. So why does Corrin sound so grave after such a victory? John had hoped that the arrival of men from the Shadow Tower would lift the spirits in the camp. Only last night he was coming back through the dark from a piss when he heard 5 or 6 men talking in low voices around the embers of a fire. When he heard Chet muttering that it was past time they turned back, John stopped to listen.
It's an old man's folly, this ranging, he heard. We'll find nothing but our graves in them mountains. There's giants in the Frostfangs, and wargs, and worse things, said Lark the Sister Man. I'm not going there, I promise you. The old bear's not like to give you a choice.
Might be, we won't give him one, said Chet.
Just then one of the dogs had raised his head and growled, and he had to move away quickly before he was seen. I was not meant to hear that, he thought. He considered taking the tale to Mormont, but he could not bring himself to inform on his brothers, even brothers such as Chet and the Sister Man. It was just empty talk, he told himself. They are cold and afraid. We all are. It was hard waiting here, perched on the stony summit above the forest, wondering what the morrow might bring. The unseen enemy is always the most fearsome. John slid his new dagger from its sheath and studied the flames as they played against the shiny black glass. He had fashioned the wooden hilt himself and wound hempen twine around it to make a grip. Ugly, but it served. Dolores Ed opined that glass knives were about as useful as nipples on a knight's breastplate, but John was not so certain. The dragonglass blade was sharper than steel, albeit far more brittle. It must have been buried for a reason. He had made a dagger for Gren as well, and another for the Lord Commander. The war horn he had given to Sam. On closer examination, the horn had proved cracked, and even after he had cleaned all the dirt out, John had been unable to get any sound from it. The rim was chipped as well, but Sam liked old things, even worthless old things. Make a drinking horn out of it, John told him, and every time you take a drink, you'll remember how you ranged beyond the wall all the way to the Fist of the First Men. He gave Sam a spearhead and a dozen arrowheads as well, and passed the rest out among his other friends for luck.